Welcome to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks. I'm Stephanie Fruin, and I'm excited to be finally delivering to you my first author of Season 2. Yes, it has taken me a year to do so, but I'm sure you will agree it has been worth the wait. The Author's Tale is a series of casual conversations with prominent and influential New Zealand authors who have made their mark in New Zealand and overseas. They have often gone under the radar in their home country, but have contributed to New Zealand's cultural history in a way that if they were musicians, would be considered rock stars of their genre. They are the word stars of New Zealand literature. Not wanting to focus on a particular book or work, I'm more interested in speaking with the author in their own surroundings and getting an idea of where they have come from and what has influenced their journey to date. We meet, where possible, in their homes, not in a studio, so you may hear others moving around or pets coming to say hi. We drink coffee or tea and eat fruitcake made using my mother's recipe. She was the person who encouraged my love of a good book and great writing, so it seems fitting to include her. My first author for Season 2 is a multi-award-winning fantasy writer who is highly respected amongst fantasy writers and readers, especially in the USA, where she has a fabulous following who are waiting with great anticipation for the launch of her fourth book in her Wall of Night series. They will have to wait a little longer yet. I'm talking about Helen Lowe. Her first novel, Thornspell, published by Knopf in 2008, received great critical praise and won the Sir Julius Vogel Award for Best Young Adult Novel. And in 2012, book one of the Wall of Night series, Air of Night, won the UK Gemmell Morning Star Award for Best Fantasy Newcomer. And book two of the series, The Gathering of the Lost, was shortlisted for the Gemmell Legend Award in 2013. Book three, Daughter of Blood, was released in 2016 to more critical praise. And like I said before, book four, The Chaos Gate, is now eagerly anticipated by all who follow her. But not only is she a novelist, she is also a poet, interviewer and blogger, and a completely fabulous person. So fabulous, in fact, that we don't meet where she writes. That's her well-hidden writing hut, which is located somewhere on the Canterbury Plains. Its location we keep secret. Instead, we catch up in a meeting room at the South Christchurch Library in Christchurch, New Zealand, on a very stormy day. It's a busy place and you will hear other people moving around and talking, doors banging, and to top it off, we have wild weather with wind howling and blowing rain and hail against the windows. It's not overly warm in this room, and for that reason we keep our coats on. So that funny noise that keeps popping up and sounds like a weird kind of rubbing is actually a leather jacket making its presence felt. But please do not be put off. Keep listening, because you will be entertained, educated and enlightened by what Helen has to say.
You know, in Christchurch, there's just so many interruptions.
Oh, yeah.
And you're one of them.
Well, thank you. I mean, I do think that the New Zealand writing community is larger and more diverse than that the sort of little bit of public exposure would lead you to believe.
Yeah, absolutely. It's huge. And we cover all genres. Mm. You know, whereas if you said to someone, oh, what do you think of New Zealand writing? In fact, I did actually ask this question of someone I know just quite recently. I said, oh, it's all a bit dark and gloomy. But I think that perhaps was more based on maybe those books that have been turned into movies, which are all quite dark and gloomy.
Our movies are very dark and gloomy.
Yeah. And then you start sort of firing at names. Oh, never heard of them. Never heard of them. It's like, what a shame. You need to hear of this person and you need to go and pick up their book and have a read. And then I was having a chat with one of the librarians at the City Library there in town. This is last year, about an author's work, trying to find it. And I said, oh, it'd be so much easier if you just had all of the New Zealand authors in the children's department in one spot. So I could just go to and find this person. They said, if we did that, no one would take them out.
Yeah, exactly.
And I thought, what a shame.
It's that cultural cringe.
Yeah, that cultural cringe. I don't think that's changing.
Well, I'd like to. But I mean, you know, I've had experiences like I did an event years ago now, and the person who was managing, were they managing the event or just managing the book side of sales side of things? But anyway, he was sort of saying, well, you know, that basically I was all right because I had been published, and my books were published in America and the UK.
Yeah.
Internationally, but authors who were just local, that he didn't actually say it in those words, but the implication was pretty clear. They're just not up to the same standard. And I think that, and certainly a bookseller in Papanui at Northlands definitely said that that sticker that says New Zealand author was like the kiss of death for a book, for a genre. The only books, he said, it's not the kind of, it might be all right on very, you know, modernist, contemporary realism type fiction, but he said, that's not what we sell here. You know, we're very much in the more popular genres, the crime. And that had been my impression always just as a reader, that it was kind of like the kiss of death. And that was basically what he said. People won't buy them. They won't try them.
Isn't that interesting? And yet I think, because I've got two teenagers and in their curriculum now at school, I mean, I think we always had to do New Zealand Lit, but they seem to be perhaps doing more of it.
Yeah, definitely. I had, you know, I think, suspect I'm a little older than you, but I definitely had to read some New Zealand literature when I was at school. So Catherine Mansfield, John Mulgan, Manalone, I think that's John Mulgan.
Yeah,
and there were some short stories and a bit of Morris G.
And Marshall.
So, you know, there was a little bit, but certainly not a lot. And unfortunately, I think that anything that you're obliged to read as part of a curriculum, has to be like super good, super gripping to for you to rate it. You know what I mean?
True, because especially as a teenager or something.
Yeah,
isn't it?
And
there's so much competition.
Yeah,
for your attention as a teenager, especially these days when they're so screen focused. Well, Helen, thank you so much for meeting with me. I mean, and this has taken ages for us to get this.
But that's fine, sorted. You know.
But
writing hoping, like gardens is patient.
Good things take time. So you sparked my interest because you write in a genre that I know very little about, but I'm really curious about it, and I have read more fantasy and sort of sci-fi and more in the last couple of years than I've ever read, and I think maybe that comes back from when I was a teenager and we had to read I will think of the name and I'll... No, Z for Zachariah.
Okay,
And I found it, I think, quite... I don't want to use the word depressing.
Z for Zachariah is a post-apocalyptic science fiction novel by Robert C. O'Brien, published in 1974. It's written as a diary entry by 16-year-old Anne Burden whilst living in a small valley with an isolated microclimate, having survived a nuclear war and nerve gas. Yep, it was a real chirpy tale. No wonder it made an impact.
Who's the word depressing?
Well, dystopias often are depressing.
Yeah, it was depressing. And I think I probably decided that anything that wasn't of this realm, was perhaps a little bit maybe depressing or harder to read or harder to get my head around. And I was probably just lazy, I suppose. But that said, then I went on and did a degree in literature and all the rest of it. But yeah, so I have read more fantasy, sci-fi, etc. over the last few years than ever before, and I look at your work and I go, it's huge. Like, the scale of it is huge, and the worlds you build are huge, and they're so complex, and the work that it takes to create them in your head and then on paper is vast. That's a huge amount of work. These aren't 24-hour, 2-week, 3-week, 1-month, 2-month turnaround times. Mm. These are years' worth of thought and time and effort. And I think that's fabulous. And I want to know more about it. Okay. Hope that's okay.
Yeah, no, that's fine. It's fine.
And I love it. I love the fact that you work in this area, which even I'm sure there has to be a great sort of fan club base in New Zealand, but it really strikes me that offshore, especially in the States, there's a huge fan club base.
I can give you an interesting statistic, because it actually didn't happen. Well, it happened online, but it didn't happen. New Zealand offered to host the World Science Fiction Fantasy Convention, and the year was 2020. And
So
it had to be online in the end. But, you know, there was a lot of challenges for the local people in organising it. And I was doing an interview with some people in the States, authors and podcasters. But and they were sort of asking about scale and you know what it would be like to come to a con in New Zealand, and I can't remember what the question was, but it was about organization. And I said, well, just bear this in mind, if in New Zealand a con, an average con, is only about 100 people, right? The science fiction fantasy convention. Mm-hmm. A really good, an amazing con would be 200 people. And that blew their mind, because in America, 2,000 is more like your starting thing. So the size of a world con in New Zealand was likely going to be the size of a very small con in America, you know, and they just sort of go up from there.
Yeah.
So I think they just didn't really appreciate the difference in scale. I mean, you get, I think Armageddon, those things like Armageddon, you
get
a lot
bigger.
You get a lot of people through, but they are kind of going more, I mean, they're doing the full gamut. Art, the art, the movies, the theater, the books, you know.
The gaming online.
So I think that whereas the conventions tend to be more focused at sort of the more traditional arts, so, you know, books, films,
So can we, we'll just take a step back, and I've got here sitting in front of me is your poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So when you were younger, have you always written? Is it something you've always done?
From about 8 years old, yes.
Yeah, and what was it that sparked your interest in being a writer? Was there something, was there a moment that happened and you went, ah?
There wasn't a moment. It was more just a natural evolution. I loved stories, you know, listening to them on the radio, reading them in books my parents read to me, and I just love stories, and what we love, we want to do ourselves.
Yeah.
So I started writing from a very early age, and I'm what come from a large family, and we had friends that we played with, so I actually started writing plays first.
Fabulous.
So that we could all, little plays that we all performed for our proud or otherwise parents.
Brilliant. And whereabouts were you? Where were you brought up?
I've lived in a number of places. Yeah. So I was born in New Zealand, but at that time we were living in Singapore. We lived there for just over 3 years, I think. Mm. So my father worked for the Port of Singapore. Mm. So
a strong expat community probably there too.
Yeah, it was. Mm. It was. It was very tail end of empire. But as a kid, you don't really, to probably just, maybe if I'd been a little bit older, I would have had more insights into that.
Yeah.
But
Oh, how fabulous. So your writers, you did little plays. Have you kept them? You must have kept them.
No.
Really?
No, I've got a lot of early writing material, but not the plays. There was only a couple of them, so yeah.
Mm. Oh, goodness me. And then the poetry?
Yes.
When did this sort of begin?
About the same time.
And you obviously kept that up.
Yeah, right through. And I have to say that my early poetry was extremely derivative.
Everybody says that, though, don't they?
I suspect it is. I think I still have a book with poems in it, and some of them look very like the daffodils. And,
of course.
You know, and then when I discovered Tolkien, of course, which was when my early teens, and he has a lot of poetry in The Lord of the Rings. And some people hate that, but I loved it.
Yeah.
I loved it, and I can definitely see a strong Tolkien influence on my poetry from that time. Both its subject matter and its style.
Yeah.
But then, of course, when I went to university and I also did a degree in literature and studied Old English, I realised that how a lot of those, not all of the poems, but like the riders, the song of the Riders of Rohan in book The Two Towers is an Anglo-Saxon, a fragment of an Anglo-Saxon poem. So So, of course, his specialty as an academic was Norse, Old Norse, and that Anglo-Saxon world. Yeah. So I think Norse in particular.
Yeah.
And the influence of that. See, when I was a kid, I also loved myth and legend.
Yes, oh, well, you can tell that.
Yeah.
I thought you must have.
Yeah, the Greek. I discovered the Greek first, and then went on to the Norse, and I sort of progressed through, and I think I sort of ran out of steam somewhere in the Babylonian or something. But
so when you say as a kid that sparked your interest, and I'm thinking when I was that age, there was no outlet or avenue in the traditional educational program that looked at that. We did not do any Greek mythology or Norse mythology. We didn't do any of it at all. So
we didn't study it, but
so how did you sort of get onto it? And
well, it was through school. Yeah. One of my teachers, when I was in I don't know, I lose track of the years, but it was roughly what we would call Standard Four. But this was an English model school in Singapore. But she, for some reason, she had this beautiful poster, really big poster of the 12 Olympians.
Here's a great spot for me to take a quick break to learn about the 12 Olympians. The 12 Olympians are the 12 great gods of ancient Greece who had a home on Mount Olympus where they would meet and discuss matters. Not things like what to buy for dinner and whose turn it is to wash up, you know, all those sorts of things. No, real issues. Much more complex. The Olympians are those familiar names in Greek mythology we've all heard of. Hades, the god of wealth and underworld. Poseidon, the sea. Zeus, god of the sky and king of the gods. Dionysus, god of the vine. Aphrodite, goddess of fertility, love and beauty. Apollo, the god of music and art, and his twin sister Artemis, the goddess of hunting. Ares and Athena, the god and goddess of war. Demeter, the goddess of harvest and fertility. Hephaestus, the god of fire. And Hera, the goddess of marriage and the queen of Olympus.
A really big poster of the 12 Olympians. And the colours were beautiful and the art was beautiful. Yeah. And it had a little paragraph about each of the 12 gods. And I just went, wow, that's so fascinating.
Yeah.
And then I went home and I knew my parents had an old encyclopedia, Piers Encyclopedia, and it was very old and it had a whole classical mythology section. So I pretty much read that and then I just went to the library.
You just devoured it.
And I just started getting any book that was about the Greek myths and legends. And then, as I said, I went on to North Celtic folklore, fairy tale.
Yeah.
I already liked fairy tales, but, you know, so there was that whole thing. So it's like a single spark, you know, the match is lit.
Yep.
And it's so actually, I wrote a book, a short story in the early noughts called The Brother King.
Oh, I've got that one here. Yeah.
And, The Brother King was a finalist in the Raymond Carver competition in the States, and then it made their Best in Year anthology. But I remember talking about it with Owen Marshall, and he had read it, and he said, did you have to do a lot of research to write that story because of that Troy and Greece? And I said yes and no. Mm-hmm. Yes, because I've been reading this, all the stuff, both history, the myths, starting with the myths and legends, but I've read real history, I've read there's some non-fiction histories, I've read historical novels. I'm just sort of steeped in that whole thing.
Yeah.
And the story came out of that. So the answer was no, I didn't need to do a whole bunch of research just to write that story.
Yeah.
I did fact check a few things, obviously, once I'd written, you know, just sort of, the story just wrote itself pretty much. And then, you know, and then I thought, okay, I need to check this, I need to check that. But
I feel so neglected not being taught any of that Greek mythology, because I just love it. I think it's fabulous.
Yeah.
And all that ancient history, and the Norse history, and just the Vikings, and, you know, just all of that.
I do think, I mean, this is just my, I mean, because I love it.
Yeah.
But I think that the way we seem to, like, be increasingly narrowing and simplifying what we learn. So, you know, so it's kind of like, it, to me, like, we lament that there's not enough people studying STEM core, whatever, maths and science and things. But, you know, it seems to me that we keep simplifying and and narrowing our education. It does feel like a dumbing down to an extent to me, but you know, I'm probably a jaundiced observer, but I also I guess feel sometimes like we're learning more and more about less and less, and the corollary of it is so you can say, well, here's a person who's done a degree in English literature. You wouldn't expect her to have an appreciation of maths and science so much, but you see, I'm absolutely fascinated by history, and that includes the history of science.
Yes.
And I've read a lot about it. And for my third book in the Wall of Night series, Daughter of Blood, I started reading, I did do quite a bit of research about siege warfare and how different kinds of sieges, famous sieges, started with famous sieges, and then it. But, you know, your material expands out. Yeah. And so it was kind of like I just got fascinated by reading about the siege warfare itself. And one of its branches it took was the evolution of medicine in relation to war.
Yeah.
So the Duke de Guise in the 1500s, I think, pretty sure it was 1500s, he was famous for, he was, it was in the Catholic Protestant wars, but he was famous for treating, he just started treating the wounded of the enemy and his own wounded in a very similar way, like giving them medical treatment and things like that. And there were other things that he did, but it was all about sanitation because typhus killed more soldiers than war did. And it was absolutely, and so, you know, there was reading all this stuff about, you know, typhus and how a lot of the public health thing started from that, and then, and how important it was in sieges because dysentery, typhus, you know, all those things. That's what killed people. And as well as starvation. But and bullets. But, you know, and arrows. But, you know, and but then I sort of, because I got into it, I was just reading on. And then I read about surgery, which was also developed from war, you know, limbs and, you know, and the evolution of surgery, which of course came into anaesthetics. And of course, not of course, but the Wall series, of course, is an analogue medieval type Renaissance world. So it was quite funny when I was getting towards the end of the book and, you know, there were a lot of kind of wounded and, you know, and it's sort of like how they would have been treated then and how we would treat them now. And I did have a emergency doctor who was kind enough to read some of my stuff for me, and he said, look, you've done this really, really well, really well. And I said, and I was thinking that when it got to anesthetic, I think we'll just have to go for healing magic. And he said, healing magic, we were emailing, not he said, healing magic is a great you know, catch-all. So it was kind of, but so I guess what I'm saying is that I feel like my writing is enriched by curiosity about many aspects of the world and preparedness to learn about it. And I'm really grateful that in my education, not, I suppose part of it was my choice, that I chose to do science and arts right through to the end. My school was small and it didn't offer classics. My brother's school did at that stage. It was still part of the curriculum. But, I had my interest in that. And so, I think trying to Yeah.
Anyway. I think you're right, though. I think the correlation between the sciences and the maths and the and mythology and history and literature, they totally blend together. I mean, you look at especially what you've, the era and the worlds that you write about, they relied so heavily on astrology and astronomy as well.
Until about 500 years ago, people didn't distinguish between astronomy and astrology.
No, exactly. The two were blended, and they absolutely believed and were very in tune with worlds other than the physical world, you know. I think that's kind of coming back. I think the courtesy of the pandemic, more people, this is my own little thought, that more people have had a chance to sit in their own little bubbles and become more in tune with what else is going on beyond their four walls, which aren't necessarily of this time and place. And I think that's what, of course, you have been writing about for so long, which is just fascinating. But look, can we have a look at some of your poetry?
Yeah.
I think the poetry is great. One thing I have to say is you're really hard to find, you know, copies of and things like that.
Well, that's because, I mean, poetry is not my main thing.
And
so
it's
I've never
anthologies.
Yeah, and I've never published a book, you see. So you can't just go and grab Helen Lowe's book.
Exactly.
So I've had about 50 poems published, but I've never but they're not collected in one place.
No, but I did dig around online and what I thought was really interesting is a lot of your poetry is you can sort of see it has elements of your fantasy writing. Would you say fantasy, or just it is definitely fantasy?
Fantasy.
Yeah.
I've written a little bit of science fiction.
Yeah.
But I mean, to me, I mean, this is just me, my rule of thumb, and there's probably a thousand out people to disagree with me.
Yeah.
Science fiction predicts a world or conceives of a world that should be scientifically able to be foreseeable, like space travel or something like that. Fantasy is a magical world.
Yeah.
You know, it's an alternate world. Yeah. It's sort of tends to be far more imbued with myth and legend and, you know, and I think to me, I mean, you know, people may disagree with me, but I think to be fantasy, there has to be some element of magic in
well,
there.
Well, it's fantastical.
It's fantastical, exactly. There's something, there's some, however small, there must be kind of a grain of the fantastic or the magical in there. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with you. I totally agree with you. Anyway, so looking at your poetry, here's our great weather turning
up. Yeah, yeah.
And I wondered, I've copied out the ones that I particularly liked, I guess because they're quite different to your books. And I like having that kind of contrast, I suppose, of your writing. I really like From the Hill, which was published in 2007 in the Takahe magazine.
Yeah.
So I've got that one, and I've also got The Wayfarer, which I just thought was a beautiful piece of writing. I loved it.
Yeah.
Now, can you explain for me, so you've got The Wayfarer, and then sort of as a subtitle, Odysseus at...
Dodoma. Okay.
Can you explain that?
Okay, so The Wayfarer is a part of a cycle of poems called Ithaca Conversations, and it is based around the legends... come history, come myth of the Trojan War, the Trojan conflict. Yeah. And so I'll take a slant into a particular aspect.
Yeah.
And Odysseus, after Odysseus returned, so there's the Iliad, which is about the Trojan War, the Odyssey, which is about Odysseus's return home. But there are other stories, and one of them is after he returned to Ithaca, he then had to go on a pilgrimage. And he had to walk with... Now, it was to atone for something that he did on his journey. And I've forgotten off the top of my head what it was. I would have to fact-check that. But it was a journey of atonement. And he had to walk with an oar upon his shoulder. And there was a couple of other things, as in a ship's oar. So he was a sailor on land. So he had to walk to a land where people... where there was no salt and they had never heard of the sea.
Wow.
Now, when I was first reading the myths, I thought, well, you know, that's kind of impossible that there would be a land without salt and they'd never heard of the sea.
Yeah.
But in fact, Switzerland, I believe, I've since learned as an adult, is landlocked in the centre of Europe, and I believe there's no naturally... I've read somewhere, it's just a fact that may be incorrect, but there was no naturally occurring salt there.
Yeah.
So, you know, even in a myth, there can be something that sounds fantastic and may not be as fantastic. So he had to go on this journey to atone for whatever the crime was that he'd made. And so what I have here is him arriving, the grove in the north of Greece.
Yes.
There was a big shrine to Zeus and sacred grove of oak trees and things, but it was at Dodona.
Yeah.
So it was a big, and Zeus was the king of the gods. So he's arriving at the shrine of Dodona. Mm. And that's from the myth, and everything else I've just made up, like kind of imagining how it would be. And so the crone that he meets with is made up, you know, and, you know, it's just all chance.
I just love it. I think it's just completely fabulous.
Mm.
And I wondered, would you read it?
Yeah, sure.
I've got it right here for you.
I'm happy to read both of them if you'd like me to.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll read.
Do this one first because we've just been talking about
it. Okay,
all right. And then we'll listen to the other one as well. But I just think it's fabulous.
Okay. The Wayfarer, Odysseus at Dodona. Acorns lie strewn with old leaves, thick as years beneath the shadow of spreading oaks, where an old woman stoops, picking up sticks that are no more or less twisted than she, binding them onto her bent back, and watching with one bright blackbird eye as the wayfarer approaches, an oar balanced across his knotted shoulder, his eyes narrowed between deep seams, as one who has looked out to numerous horizons and seen wonders. The moon's twinned horns rising from a twilight sea like some mythic beast, awe and terror bound into the one moment of seeing. Those same eyes strayed now into this land of low green hills, where the margin of the world is always close as the line of the next wooded slope meeting sky, and where a crone hobbles closer beneath her load, head twisted up to see him better, curious as a crow, cackling to think there can be any burden greater than hers in this world of suffering, flapping work-worn hands and husking at him in her cracked voice, bidding him return to the hearth fire and the home aisle, to sit in the sunlit porch with grandchildren clutching at his knees. But the wanderer hears only the ravens cawing, lifting in clouds from the sacred grove, darkening the sun with their wings, crying out that he is fated, condemned to roam across sea and land, never resting or knowing ease until he comes at last to some far country where salt too is a stranger, and no traveller has ever brought word to those who dwell there, or led them to imagine the immeasurable vastness, the restless expanse of the great ocean that is the circumference, the greater part of an unknown world.
Fabulous. I love it. I just love it. I think in the description, your description of the woman, the sticks that are no more or less twisted than she, you can just picture her perfectly, absolutely perfectly. It's wonderful. The Wayfarer. So it was a finalist in the Takahe National Poetry Competition in 2006, and it was published in Takahe in 2007. So now let's also have a listen to From the Hill as well, which I just particularly love.
From the hill, boats turn at their moorings, facing into the wind. I can see every shift in the weather from up here, she says, standing at my shoulder. The boat's better than any weather vane. We take our tea out, onto a deck made of timber from old hulks dredged out of harbour mud. She speaks of the home to which she does not return, of the much younger man who will not let her go, nor she him, turns again to watch the boats, talks of a change in the wind.
And I wonder what that brought, the change in the wind.
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? And I think if anyone's ever sat and watched boats and just watched the sea and how it changes and what you can tell by watching the ocean, you know, and all of those myths and legends you're talking about, so often the sea is a huge character, isn't it?
Yeah.
In them, it is a, it is a real character within their story, and it brings a sense of foreboding or joy, or you can tell so much. So even though the style of that writing is so different to the style in your books, it's still, you can still get those
I think there's every writer, and now is it Kate DeGoldie who says every writer has a bone and they gnaw on it, and you'll find it in all their writing, you know, it'll come out in all their writing. I certainly think the natural world, the natural world, also the emotional world, the human, the emotional human world, history, myth, they're all kind of bones that are sort of your spot in my writing, regardless of whether it's poetry or you know, the fantasy novels, or I've written realist short fiction. So, you know, that has no magic in it.
No.
So,
And probably the last one of the poems that I want to sort of look at is the one that Jacinda Ardern used part of when, you know, post our earthquakes here in Christchurch, and it was 10 years on, and she was giving an address at the memorial service, and she used the last few sort of lines of your poem as sort of a summing up of, I suppose, Christchurch is now coming out of the gloom and out of everything. I mean, you know, the sparrows are returning, the birds are starting to chirp again. And what I thought was interesting about the sparrows, well, it caught my eye because my daughter, when she was 8, wrote a poem about sparrows and about how their shadow, as they go on a, you know, a group of them, they cast a shadow. And then it goes, you know, and that was her poem, and it was just a great observation, I thought, of an 8-year-old of that. So it caught my eye. It was, the sparrows. But I think having lived in Christchurch and been here during our earthquakes, I remember vividly the fact it was dead silent. It was weird. That struck me as being so odd. And there was no flies. Not even a fly in February, which normally that's their time when they're setting themselves up to, you know, last throughout the winter. And people who had abandoned tables at restaurants or cafes or just even their own homes and left food out went back months later, as we did, to our place, and it was all still there. No fly had been in, and it was so odd, so odd. So I thought your sparrows poem was great in that you totally embodied that atmosphere that we had, and I could really relate to it, as I'm sure everyone in Christchurch at the time can relate to it. And I thought, how fab! Did you know Jacinda Ardern was going to read it?
No, I did not know. I was
a shame.
It was a shame in a way, except that I know people who were there that day and they couldn't hear a word because the sound system was apparently so bad.
Oh no!
But like, cause all the speakers were on one side of the river where the wall is,
and they most were
on the other side, and apparently the sound system was terrible. But I knew nothing about it. There were two. I found out two ways. Was one is I got a call very early in the morning from my partner, say, and I just thought when I saw it was him calling and it was so early, I just thought, well, it's bad news. You know, it's bad news. But anyway, and he said, look, I was just reading an overseas newspaper online and they were reporting on the event in Christchurch yesterday, and the Prime Minister read your poem or part of your poem as part of her speech, or finished her speech with your poem. And I was like, wow, that's so amazing. You know, it just sort of blew me away. But, and then the thing that really made me laugh was that when I did go onto my blog a little later in the day just to check, I kind of went, wow, something happened to my statistics overnight. They just went, like, my normal traffic just went completely off the charts because it had been reported on overseas newspapers, and the poem was actually on my blog. And people had linked to it. Some of these newspapers had linked to it. And so people had gone to read the poem, and it was like, wow, you know, it was...
What a shame. I think it's just such a shame that she, that no one from her, her press office had contacted you, or just sent you a wee note, or just something, you know. Because it's a big moment when someone...
It was actually a pretty big moment. And
As a writer, that's a big moment.
I mean,
it's like a fashion designer being chosen to wear the dress on the red carpet at the BAFTAs, in a way. Do you know what I mean?
That
kind of time.
It was pretty huge. I think that, and if I'd known it was going to happen, I would have tried and been there, you know.
Yeah.
But I think that I did find out because I knew someone who worked in the office of another minister.
Yeah.
And because part of me was like, because you want to go, well, you know, my poem was chosen.
Yeah.
And then you go, but was it the prime minister who actually chose it, or was it just someone in her department? And, you know, and it's just, you know, it's that kind of thing. Mm. But in fact, what he said, he did some digging, and what he found out was that yes, a there was an anthology called Leaving the Red Zone, and yes, a staffer did go through and select a number of potential poems, but then it was the Prime Minister that made the final decision and you know, chose the quote, and so that was kind of quite, and the little sparrows have flown reasonably high actually, because they've also been incorporated into a painting
by
a Dunedin artist, so Claire Bainham, one of her paintings, and it's also called The Sparrows.
Fabulous. Let's hear it. Do you want to read that one too?
Yes, I will read the Sparrows. I meant it to be a poem about sparrows and how the silence that followed the February 22nd earthquake included their absent voices. And not just the sparrows, but the starlings and blackbirds, the finches and waxeyes that normally fill the day with their bustle about the business of living. All fallen silent, hidden away or gone further to find food, since half the city was covered in a slick of water and mud. I threw old bread onto the island of grass in our own grey sea and waited and waited. And then finally they came, their wings clouding the sun.
Thank you.
You have been listening to part one of season two of The Author's Tale, featuring Helen Lowe, presented and produced by me, Stephanie Fruin. I hope you've enjoyed part one of Helen's tale. Don't forget to follow to get instant notifications of future episodes, including part two of Helen's story, where we discuss her first published novel, Thornspell, the difficulties of getting published, and hints and tips of obtaining a fabulous agent. You can find out more about Helen on her website, www.helenlowe.info. The link is also in the show notes. Thank you for listening to The Author's Tale, brought to you by Edition Audiobooks and Digital Publishing, helping you bring your books to life. EditionAudiobooks.com.